a major thing that we do, and we do it all the time, we don't even realize it, and the psychologists, psychiatrists do it, called reframing. It's seeing a picture in a different frame. And sponsors do it, and we do it with each other. And what happened with Earl when he was standing the other night. He was going to walk out of the meeting because he couldn't make it. He just couldn't make it. He was just giving up. He'd never make it. He's going to leave. And so he has to walk out. And the sponsor goes to the microphone and yells, "Earl, we're having a meeting." And he goes, oh yeah, we're having a meeting. And he turns around, goes back to the meeting, and forgets that he's going to kill himself or whatever he was going to do. And cutting things down to a day at a time is a different way of reframing. Or looking at alcoholism as a disease rather than as a bad habit. It's just changing the framing of it. It makes it worse. And we can do that with each other. I think the most important thing, of course, that's the thing I want to stress, is that I think prioritizing. We have to have a priority. I mean, I couldn't stay physically sober until being physically sober was the most important thing in my life. Nothing was more important than my physical sobriety. I can't have my emotional sobriety unless it's right close to that. And most of the things that I get upset with just aren't worth it. They're just not that important. How important is it? How important is it? How important is it compared to my sobriety? And most of the things just aren't that important. Another thing was this business of getting angry. So many of us are afraid to be angry because I guess it's because we're not sure what's going to happen if we are angry. As I see it, there's nothing wrong with anger. It's what you do about the anger. It's the action that follows the anger that matters, not the anger itself. Anger is a natural emotion. And I like the concept of constructive anger. Most of the time, anger is the action that follows anger is destructive. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's because of habit or because of emotional immaturity on our part. But Mothers Against Drunk Drivers comes to mind. Those are women that got angry, and I don't necessarily agree with everything they've done, but at least they've done something constructive with their anger. A woman who gets angry at her husband's constantly drinking, and in spite of what he says, goes off and joins Al-Anon. And stays angry enough to keep going to meetings even if he doesn't want her to go. Things like that. That's constructive anger. So it's, I like the concept of constructive anger. Another thing I see that so many times the people I'm working with are so focused on the other person that they can't look at themselves. I was talking to a fellow that I sponsored the other day, and he was talking about the fighting he was having with his neighbor woman. And that she wanted them to cut down a tree in the front that didn't need to be cut down, and she was always suing people, and she was just always in trouble with other people, and he was really crazy, and he was going on and on about how crazy this woman was, and what a troublemaker she was, and how upset he was. And the longer he talked, the more I realized how stupid it is for him to keep focusing on her, because she's much better at fighting than he is, and than he'll ever be. And the best thing he could do is get into purposeful forgetting and just forget about her and go on with his life, because he's never going to get anywhere constantly focused on her, which is what I always do. I like to focus on my problems. I like to drag things on and rather than forget them. I'm kind of like my little hour dog, Sabrina. She hates other dogs. And she even hates for another dog to bark within her hearing. If you're walking along and she hears another dog bark, she assumes they're barking at her, and by God, she doesn't stand for that. And she gets real angry, and she will bark at them, and she'll charge against the leash. She'll raise up on her hind legs to try and charge against the leash. But then we keep on walking, and we're well past where the other dog is, She doesn't forget it. She stays angry. I mean, motorcycle goes by, she's ready to tear off after them. I mean, she stays angry for a long period of time. That's her, and that's what I do. Long after the thing is going on, I'm still ruminating by it. In fact, I'm thinking of much better answers than what to do. But I need to say, cut it off, cut it off. One of the things that I've had happen with a number of people, and it's worked well for me with a daughter I've got, but when you have somebody that you really want to have them get the program, maybe it's a son or daughter, a relative, a very close friend, somebody you really love, somebody you really work with, you really want them to get it, and they can't hear anything you say. It can be so frustrating. What I find is that when I am more interested in somebody's sobriety than they are, it can be very frustrating. And I find the harder I work on it, the worse that I get, and the more upset I get. What I have done and helped other people occasionally to do is to become an interested observer. It's kind of like becoming a fly on the wall, on the ceiling or something. And from then on, I just watch. And just watch what these people or this person is doing. I'm interested. I may answer questions if they ask, but I'm not a participant. It's kind of like watching an interesting movie. I stay in the audience. I don't project myself onto the screen. I'm not part of the action. I'm really interested in what's going to happen. I wonder how this story is going to end. You know? And I can be very comfortable in that role. And I'm nearby if anything comes up that I can do something in that, but I'm not a participant. I'm just an interested observer, really interested, but just an observer. And I find that very comfortable for me. One of the things that I wanted to mention too was about resentments. What we say in the book, it tells us about praying for them and all that stuff, and that all helps a lot. But I haven't taken care of all my resentments. And I remember reading, referred to it, Emmett Fox in the Sermon on the Mount, where he's analyzing the Lord's Prayer. And Emmett Fox says, we should not say the Lord's Prayer past the part where it says, forgive me my trespasses as I forgive those who trespass against me. Don't say that if you're carrying resentments toward anybody, because you're telling God to treat you like you're treating that person. And that's dumb. He goes on to a considerable detail about how when we resent somebody, it's like we're chained, spiritually chained to that person. It's almost like a prisoner and the jailer. That the jailer is in jail as much as the prisoner is. And you can't leave, and you're spiritually chained to somebody you don't even like. And he goes on the power of forgiveness and so on. But the point I wanted to make was that you should read this. If you don't have any resentments, don't bother. But he has a particular way of handling resentments in that you pray about it over a period of time before you get ready, and you ask God to help you get ready. And when you are finally ready, you sit down and you talk to God about this resentment, and you give the resentment and the person to God and say, it's yours. It's yours now. To me, it's as if it never happened. It's yours. It's gone. It's over. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to you. It's as if it never happened. And then, this is the part I found interesting. From then on, anytime that resentment comes to your mind, you say, no, I gave that away. It never happened. you do not allow yourself to think about it because it's gone. And he says you don't have to do that very many times before it ceases to even occur. It really does disappear. And and read it. If you ever have a resentment, check that out. Along the idea of resentments, just a couple of weeks ago, I was looking through the Los Angeles Times editorial thing. I think it had to do with Easter and Passover. And it was talking about forgiveness. It was talking about the battles in Northern Ireland and in Croatia and Serbia and the Middle East. And it was talking about people forgiving their enemies. And at least two or three times in that editorial, it said that the difficulty was the question of whether or not your enemy deserved the gift of forgiveness. And I thought, God, I can't imagine that from such a prestigious source of information, they would still feel that you are giving a gift to the person you're forgiving. I think as we see it in the program, when we forgive somebody that we have resentment, we're giving a gift to ourselves. We're the ones that benefit. Screw them. I'm glad to hear you agree with me, but I didn't think that had anything to do with that. Anyhow, I guess the only thing I wanted to say was that I just want to stress the fact that to me it's important for me to be conscious of my emotional state and as to what the basis of it is, because if it's somebody else is determining my emotional state, that's stupid as far as I'm concerned. I should take control of that myself, and I must. I can't blame it on anybody else. Somebody with the old Chinese proverb. I guess all Chinese proverbs are old. It said, if you don't control your emotions will control you. And I think that's the point that I was wanting to make. There's one other thought that I don't want it to sound goody-goody, but I first picked it up in Course in Miracles, and then in Jan Polsky's Love is Letting Go of Fear, and some other places, where the guys say, people who know about these things say that there's really only two emotions. There are two emotions, either love or fear. And they claim that all other emotions are variations of either one or the other of those two themes. And in reading that, I realized that my life before the program was a fear-based life. I did things because I was afraid not to do them. I failed to do things because I was afraid to do them. Everything I did or didn't do was based on whether I feared or not what would happen if I did or didn't do that. And in the program, I find it so much more comfortable to have a love-based way of life. And that's the choice we have. We can either, to me, that's what the whole service, love and services, the whole carrying the message of AA. What was not too long ago, that Bill W., one of the two co-founders of AA, said, he wrote, that carrying the message of recovery was our primary aim and the chief reason for our existence. I thought, well, those are pretty strong words, that our primary aim and the chief reason for our existence. And then I thought, when he says our existence, does he mean us as groups or us as individuals or both? But there's nothing more important that we can do than carry the message of recovery. And then the other co-founder, Ray A., says that the whole program carrying the message can be condensed down to just love and service. Love and service. And I think that's what we do in the program. That's what we do when we come to meetings. That's what we do when we reach out to newcomers or each other. That's what it's all about. It's living a love-based life rather than a fear-based life. And finally, my motto is that if I do a thing for the right motive and leave the results up to God, it turns out the way it's supposed to. That's how I find out what God's will is. I used to sit and think and pray and ask for God to tell me His will. He never did. Never did. He has never revealed the future to me. The only way I've ever found His will is if I do a thing for the right motive, and love is always the right motive, and just leave the results up to Him, it turns out the way He wants it to be, and that's how I find out what His will is. And it's so much easier because I'm not responsible for what happens over there. I'm only responsible for my motive in doing what I did. Oh, God, I'm sounding so preachy. I think it's a good time to quit. I got one other thing before I quit. A complete change of pace here. Some years back, heard about some people down in Texas that were putting together some papers for how to study the first 164 pages of the book and how to do the steps when you came to them. You have a group and you do it, a book study, and it would be a step do it, not a step study. And I got hold of papers, completed them, corrected them, took out the typos, finished up some of the steps, made it into a pamphlet, but it's basically just it's the book. It's the book. You can't sell the book, so I put it out like computer software. Send it out for free. If you like it, use it, and want to pay for it, fine. You can make a donation. I wondered when I did it whether I'd just thrown my money away, and it turned out that alcoholics have wanted it and donated it enough that I've printed 22,000 of them so far. And I brought some along, and they're free. You can pick them up here. It's better if you don't pick them up just because they're free, but if you do pick them up, try using them. And if you need more, just let me know. The address is on the back, and I'll send them to you. And if you don't have a good rest of the week, enjoy yourself. Remember, it's your own damn fault. Thank you very much.